Herbert Burnett, Reel 3.
There's the villagers, a little bit of repetition going on, but never mind. They all have their own tower, and there must be somebody observing from that tower. You never see anybody, obviously, there. And you can always, in most cases, if you're going out on this Razmak column, or even in your own camp at the local village near us, generally hear shots ringing out, and which is a sign that two villages have in a row, you say. How they sort it out, I wouldn't know. But you're not allowed in the villages, not allowed at all. In fact, I don't suppose you dare go in them on your own, you see, because very hostile sort of people, the tribesmen, well, they were. Yeah, we've seen two or three of them. On one occasion, we had to do a forced march from Razmak down to a second midway between Razmak and Bano, anyhow. And there's been some village troubles on, and they turned us out. We had to do a forced march down there. I was out 3 days looking after this village, you see. And the local political advisor, whatever they call him, he'd been into the village and he came out with the information that there's trouble on and they wasn't going to settle it. So they gave him a short notice of time of which they were going to destroy the village, you see. And this is how they did it. If a village wouldn't come to terms, anything at all like that, they just emptied it and destroyed the village. Of course, they easily put another one up elsewhere. It didn't come to that, actually, because when they saw whoever it was causing all the trouble and the people who was laying down the terms of agreement, as soon as they saw they meant business, well, that was it. That was their little argument thing. But to us, it meant a 15-mile march back home again. So this is the problem, you see. That's the nearest we ever got to a village that was really in a troubled area, you see. Now then, we left Razmak November 36. Now the next column coming up, they bumped into trouble, and I think for about 2 years there was frontier trouble on, and some of our lads was kept behind, which I think each unit that had finished the tour of duty always left a certain few people behind as a sort of rear party, do you see, to hand over to the new unit. Well, when the new unit arrived in, they'd had this trouble on the way, and it was the beginning of a small uprising, and I think they called it the Ferker of Ippi rising or something, 1936-37. And of course, they became involved, this unit. I can't remember the name of the unit. And of course, there was a certain amount of our lads. I don't think anybody got killed or anything. I might have done. I can't remember. None of our lads did, anyhow. And they got the IGS medal, Indian General Service medal, for that. But we just missed one of those, you see, because we come down the year before. I suppose we did our job too well. It didn't catch us out. Probably that was it. I don't know. yes, that was that. And then.
Were you all glad to get off the frontier? Or would you have liked...
I don't know. I think chaps enjoyed it because, with all due respect to women, there was no women. It was a mile square and it was all men, you see. And you didn't see a woman for 12 months, only the tribal women, of course. You know, you see them potting about the villages from the outside, of course. But there was no women to be bothered with or anything at all like that. And you had your cinema and the lads had a pint of ale. It was a man's life, and I think they enjoyed it far better than being on the plains. A year was long enough, of course, because you got a bit got a bit boring after a year. But for all that, the lads enjoyed it, yes. But when you got back down on the plains, you became soldiers again, you know, peacetime soldiers, as you might call it, you see, and a little bit more bold, you know, and what have you, and all like that. Well, they didn't go for that a great deal. They had to do, but they didn't go for it. Yeah.
So, where did you go to after?
We went to a place called Jalunda, which is up top Lahore side, near Lahore, what's in trouble now, and that. And That wasn't such a long ride down. I did forget to mention the journey going up from Dinapore to Razmak. That was a 6-day train journey, that. Food on the way at various places, glad to get it over with. And then we had after we got to the main line, you know, we had to change over to a small narrow gauge railway, across a bit of a strip of a desert, and then onto Banu, which is the foothills. But coming back, we had to do the same thing. But the actual train journey was only about 2 days, because the next station was in the Punjab, and it was more towards the frontier station, you see. So that wasn't too bad. Jalandhar was a nice place. Bit select, I would say, was Jalandhar. And it's just a one battalion. No, I'm wrong. There was an artillery there, and there was an Indian regiment. That's right. And the artillery was there. There was a English artillery. There was a Indian regiment, and there was us, and a company and unit, you know, a supply unit, things like that. Bit religious on the native side.
How could you tell which group was it?
Well, because there were Sikhs in that area, do you see, and they are religious, set out the Sikhs. And me myself, I had set a job there for 6 months. I was attached to brigade headquarters at the telephone exchange, so me and another two chaps, so we was all right for 6 months. We was away from the battalion, you see, and we were responsible for lines of communication between brigade headquarters and various units. That was quite good, that. And then after 6 months, we swapped over and give somebody else a turn, you see. Of course, we had to go back into the battalion and start soldiering again. It had its cinema. A big place with Jalandhar. It had its cinema. We had the King George V Jubilee year there, 1936, did it? But you're talking 35. Oh, no, well, it wasn't that then. It wasn't that. It was our own 250th anniversary of the East Yorks. 250th anniversary. That'd be 1937, that was, because we'd come down in 36, November, it was the next year, that's right. We did that. Now, what else? Something's happened about one of the kings. Oh, yes, King George V, he died, didn't he, 1935? Yes, 1935. Well, we was at Razmak then, and the whole camp had to line this wall. I know we're going back on our steps a little bit now, just remembering. The whole camp had to line this wall all the way around. And they had a service for the king, you know. Okay? And then they had to fire a volley of blank ammunition, of course. So. And it started from one corner of the camp and it went all the way around, a mile, 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 mile. All the way around, all time, perfect. As soon as one got finished, one could run. 4 miles altogether, and they talk about 4 miles. And you all had to keep in time going right round, yeah. Each unit had its area, see, all the way around. And the camp being a mile square, and all the lot was guarded all the way around. That was in respect of a king, you see. Find a volley over his grave, you know, similar lines. But we couldn't do nothing else there, I mean, that's all we could do. Yeah. That would be 1936. Then we came down afterwards. 1937 was our own 250 years, East Yorks. That's when we celebrated that at Jalandhar. We had a big dance, a big splash up. A lot of stuff was free that year. I don't know where they got all the money from, but a lot was free. Even the canteen Babu, he laid some money out for the troops, the cinema, old Lintott. He put on free film shows, which was great for us that day, wasn't it? I mean, it didn't cost no money. And when we went to cinema those days, we went sometimes with no shirt on, just pants, that's all, and a chatty. You know what the chatty is, don't you? You know, the earthen pot with water, do you see? And that's how we went to pictures. And £8 for a ticket. And sometimes you got your ticket off the charwala, who let you have it on the strap, you see. And you paid him when you paid for your weekly tea and bun. And then you went to the cinema, all lined up, and there you was with a towel, stripped to the, which is summer weather I'm talking about, of course, stripped to the weather, to just your trousers, a towel around your shoulders, and you're chatting with cold water. That was when Alice Faye was doing the knighted job. Yes, that was that. Of course, Jullunda was a nice place. We did a lot of training from there, but not actually in Jullunda itself. We had to go out. Went to a place called Horseshoe Pear. Don't know much about it except for training. And camels was our transport that year. Yes, they brought the RASC. I don't know where they dug them up from, but brought camels in. And the signal section had six of them. And we had leather panniers, you know, with all our signal gear in, and we had to load the camels up, you know. Yes. And then before the actual column moved off, the column, the camels had already been on the way a bit, you see, because they're a bit slow moving. And we had a three or four day march there. And the band played, a regimental band and drums played all the way, all the way. When the band stopped, the drums started. All the way through the sanded lanes and all over the place, yeah. Very hard them days, but blokes enjoyed it, funny enough, yeah. And then we got to, that one lasted 30, oh, and in 1938, I, along with the other signallers, a platoon of us, all was 30 of us in the platoon, we went up in the hills again for half a year. No, yes, half a year. Oh no, I think I went up for all the 6 months. I think the signals did well that year. They went up for all 6 months. And that was a very nice place with that. I forget what they call it now. But it was a very nice place. And lovely walks and everything. You didn't do a lot of work. But we had to keep in touch with one station. I think it was about 50 miles away with a heliograph, you see. And we had our point to go to, a high point. And then each day at 12 o'clock, we used to set our heliograph up, you know, the heliograph with the sun, you know, and that, and this point was on top of a hill, and we used to set the during 12 o'clock every day, we had to open communication. Of course, we had a company out there, you see, on detachment, away, and they was having a good holiday up there, they was all right, but you had to keep in touch, and it wasn't running down by telephones at all like that, so we only had the heliograph, so we had to wait while the sun was at its best, you see, and open up and set any messages we're telling her to send out to the company, we had to send them out and they would receive message and send them back to us again.
Were they very heavy to carry?
Oh, aye, heliographs, very heavy gear, yes. Well, considering you've got your own gear as well. I mean, if you went on exercise, after the mules had got you to the place, the main place of unloading, shall I say, and if you had to go any further on the exercise, you had to carry your gear from there. And as well as your pack and your ammunition and your pouches and whatever, rifle, you also had your whatever signal equipment you was using. If it was night time, you had the signal lamps, and that was a box. Can't remember now, it's big one. You know, you can say half the size of that speaker with a leather strap and batteries inside of it on your shoulders and a stand, so you screw it on top. One, another one to carry the stand, one to carry the lamp, of course. Oh, yes, you carried your gear.
What happened if you were going out all day and all night? Did you have to take two sorts of equipment?
If you're going out all day and all night, if you're going on a long thing like that, then you had your mule transport with you, do you see? And the mule transport took you to the dispersal area, shall I put it like that. And then from the dispersal area, whatever part of the train you were going on, you carried your gear from there. If it was night time, you had lamp. If it was daytime, you had helios. Do you see? And that's it. And also, if you're on telephone, you had 600 yards of cable on your hip, if you were the telephone fella. And you had to run with that cable and lay it out and fix the telephone at each end. Oh, yes. 600 yards of it. And yes, well, when you, especially on range duty, see, range duty, you go back cable 600 yards, you see. So the signallers, they would go with two telephones and a reel of cable on the hip, you see, with harness with a reel of cable on it, and then you go from the 600-yard firing point, unloosen the end, Give the signal who was going to signal from the firing point. Give the end. The chap who was going in the butts, he'd have the drum, the cable. He'd run like the devil down, and his cable was unwinding as he was going. This chap at the end was fastening it down with an earth pin and the end of the cable onto the telephone. You were still going down to the butt end, round the corner, into the butts, earth pin in the ground, wire off that onto the telephone, the end of the cable which you've got now on the cable, onto the other connection on the telephone. Are you there? Yes, I'm here. And that was it. And then you had all that to wind in when the firing had finished. You see, you did the full 600 yards, because then, you see, the range was at 600 yards range. That's the normal, the furthest you used to practice at. And then as you finish with 600 yards, and it'll say, right, go down to 500, you see. You left the cable, you see, and then you walked down, and then you had a pin, you know, and you connected into the cable. All right, you see, so you had your continuous circuit, you see. So, no, you went down to 300 yards, 400, you did the same thing. Then when you finished, Signer used to come out the butt with his harness on, you see, and you used to go down to meet him with your telephone and then help him to reel it all in. Great fun. And many of the time that we've got ready for an exercise, going out on training, and we've had our mules come up, and they've had one. He used to be RSC, Indian Army Corps, RSC. They used to look after the mules in a different area. When you was on training, they brought the mules from there, saddled ready, do you see, with a harness on, to each company. And the signalers always got six mules and one sepoy in charge of them. And we used to load them up, do you see. Now then, more often than not, you all's got one orchid mule, do you see? And you can bet your life, in more often than enough, that orchid mule would be orchid once it got loaded. And sometimes it wouldn't let you load it. You see, you would someone had to hold its foot back, you see, or something like that. But when you got a real orchid one, as soon as you seem to get loaded up and the sail sinks on and start it down, off it used to go and away, because you were chasing your muley kids. Yes. Yes, and of course that was a job getting the mule back. You see, before you started, you were tired before you started. Yeah.
But then the mules walked with the sepoy, did they? You
were mild. Oh yes, I'd say that was only a rare occasion. Really, there was very well trained, you know, very well trained, and you got your awkward one, But the sepoy in charge, he was well trained as well. He knew what he was doing. He knew the awkward one. All right. He would say, "Oh, Sab, not that one, not that one." So he'd say, "Wait." And he used to get a strap and fasten its front hoof, you know, up, you say, and fasten it up so that it couldn't move. And that's how he had to load that up. And of course, once you let go of the strap, up. Yes, all right. And then we got to the end of Jullunder, didn't we? Nothing very important happened while we were there. Only the cloud war cloud signs coming up, you know, 38, weren't they first? When the first got signs that, you know, something was coming off, but it didn't affect us. It didn't affect us at all. I suppose we got a lot of talk, a lot of lectures and things like that at that time. That was 1938. And then in February, was it, 39, Glad? February 39, I then came home. I'd been abroad 8.5 years, I think. 8.5 years. Could have come home earlier. You see, that's a little thing, you see. A chap who went abroad in those days, he went abroad for at least 6 years. There was no saying you'd go home after a year, nothing like that. He was abroad for 6 years, and after 6 years he could elect to come home for 6 months' leave. You see, which I spoke of them two chap went with earlier on, and then he could go back again to the unit, come home for 6 months. He could get married if he'd like while he was at home, and then take his wife back with him. You see, but I elected in my service, you see, first joined up, you were 7 years and five. 7 years with the colours, 5 years with the reserve. When you're getting towards the end of your 7 years, you could extend your service if you wanted to, do you see? If you was taking to it, not everybody took to it, but if you were taking to it. Well, I took on for another 5 years, the 12. So I decided to stay abroad an extra couple of years, because I could have come on with 6 years in and left me a small bit of service to do. But the most unfortunate part, for a lot of people, the trooping season used to go from October to about March or April. And from then to the next October, there was no troop ships. So if you finished your time in, say, April, all right, you couldn't go home. You had to wait for the next trooping season. So a man who was doing only 7 years could possibly have done 7.5 years for his seven, but he didn't get nothing for it. He got his pay, but he didn't get no retribution or anything at all for doing that extra time. That's what they call, you'll have to save for a buck a year. That's what I call flipping hard lines. You see? yes, that was that. Anyhow, and then as I say, I came on then from there.
Why did you decide to stay on abroad for...
Because I enjoyed it, like a lot more people did. And I think, we sort of settled down to a nice steady routine. But then we'd get to the age of, what, about 24, 25, glad it would be, one time, when I come on.
Yeah.
1913, 1939, 26. And I think we sort of felt as though we wanted to see England again, you know. And we may have gone back, but the war came along. But I'm talking about to a peacetime India. And the war came along, of course, and that upset all plans and everything else. And, of course, I met the wife then, and Bob, your uncle, there she is. And then the war started, and then either by good fortune or whatever you like to call it, I got posted back to India. There was the same battalion that had left, you see, 3 years, May 42. We didn't join until about August, because it was a long way around. You know, they went all the way around South Africa and big convoy, you see, in wartime. It took us 12 weeks to get there. But as I say, that was wartime, and I was quite pleased to go back, really, because I knew a lot of the chaps who were still there when I left them in 39, and of course a lot had been drafted to other battalions that were going up to the Burma front and all like that. Our battalion, we was left sort of like, we was an internal security battalion, mostly in India. And they kept that role for a long time. And then in the last year of the war, then they went on jungle training and did, I think, about 6 or 8 months actual in the Japanese war, down to Rangoon. And then they all come on with the battalion, didn't they, while we was in Beverly. Yeah.
Was internal security during wartime very different from what you'd been doing?
No, it was... no, because, funny enough... We did one turnout when I got to second time in peacetime. It was more or less a peacetime effort, do you see? Especially you got your little rights, you got your little troubles, but it's more of a peacetime. Wartime seemed to be a bit different in the atmosphere of the thing, but the drill and the principle was just the same. And I remember we got to Bombay. On a Sunday, I think it was, and the battalion commander met us in, and we came up to the barracks, Calaba Barracks in Bombay, and we were told the battalion was out on its internal security, I think, which was a real smacker of a job, and that, and we were told that we wouldn't be bothered, you know. But anyhow, before the night day was out, they sent us out as well, and I had to go with our 100 lads. There was two sergeants, myself, another one. And 100 lads, well, I'm fortunate because I'd been out before, so I knew what I was more or less going amongst, you see. Well, these other poor fellas hadn't been out, till it was all right. And we went into some area of Bombay, Bicolor or somewhere. And have you been in Bombay? No. And we had to, it's got a very big native place, you know, and there's these backwoods and places, you know. And when we used to go down there, we formed four sides of a square, your platoon, four sides of a square, and the platoon sergeant in the middle, and magistrate, local magistrate, and you was a platoon sergeant, you was in the front, in the middle of the front section, you see, there's a section down there, one down there, and you had your rifle and your bayonet, and you had so many rounds of ammunition. You was loaded, but you didn't fire. You walked down the street where the trouble was, and of course, as you walked down, some of these Indians being what they are, some of them they're scattered, you see, after a lot of shouting and that's around. But this awkward street that we was going down once, as fast as we was moving that way, there was coming back behind, as you see, and of course, you've got your rear section looking at the behind, and they was putting obstacles down, you see, and as fast as we were shifting them, they were putting them back again, you see. So this magistrate, he got a bit fed up, so I said to the, I forget the officer's name now, I said, I think we'll have to fire at one of these, you see. So when we got to the end of the street, instead, we turned round to go back, but instead of picking up all the going round, he just ordered one block to kneel down and just to fire up over the heads, you see. So he never fired to kill unless you were sort of being fired at, you see. So we had to fire one, and as soon as we fired a shot and let them know that it was whistling above the head sort of business, that was it, that cleared it, that quietened it, you
just,
see.
Just one man shooting?
Only one man, yes, just one man, that's all, yeah. Just detail a block, you see, say, all right, I'll call him Vanessa now, just fire at that block there, you see, I think he's a ringleader, just above his head, so he can hear something going over, you see. And that cleared it, that cleared it. Altogether, yeah. And funny enough, the old McLaren was coming down the street that day. He's dead now. He was a major, an officer, and he.